I kind of had to confront this head on when I was reading a New York Times story 5 or 7 years ago that opened with the line. It was a story about Mostar and Bosnia-Herzegovina. And Mostar is not a city in hot conflict, right? And yet it's a city in this kind of cold civic peace, I think you might call it, but it's far from ideal. The story begins with the line, when there is a fire on the Catholic side of the city of Mostar, the Muslim fire department does not respond. And when there's a fire on the Muslim side, the Catholic fire department does not respond. And it just so happened that I'm reading this story when I'm in Bend, Oregon on a family vacation with my family, and there's like literally fires on three sides of us, you know, wildfires. And I have this realization, oh my gosh, there's all of these people fighting these fires and keeping my family safe. And I don't know how they voted. I don't know how they pray. And they probably disagree with me on lots and lots of things, right? I'm like, in some ways, a quintessential urban, highly educated progressive. I live in Whole Foods America. And yet, we have a nation because we fight fires for everybody. We pick up garbage for everybody.
And now, The Good Fight with Yascha Monk.
My name is Sam Khan. I'm an editor at Persuasion. And I wrote a piece recently called What Small Towns Taught Me. It's a reflection on my time as a documentary producer and the view that gave me of different parts of the country. And then it's an analysis of the problems that the Democratic Party has in connecting to the American heartland. The argument is that the Democrats have a reckoning coming for them sooner or later. They already have two strikes against them in being associated with taxes and regulation, and are in danger of electoral catastrophe if, in addition to that, they continue to be tonally out of touch with the country. It seemed to me to be something that's important to say and that can be lost in the Democrats' echo chambers, and I hope you check it out.
Sam Khan's article, A Reckoning is Coming for the Democrats, was published by Persuasion. To learn more about the community we're building at Persuasion and to get similar articles directly into your inbox, head to www.persuasion.community.
My guest today is Eboo Patel. Eboo is the founder and the president of Interfaith America, the largest interfaith organization in the United States. And he is the author, among other things, of We Need to Build, Field Notes for Diverse Democracy. A much more concrete book, tilling some of the same ground as my book called The Great Experiment, a really insightful book, I think, on how to make diverse democracies work in a realistic way. I learned a lot from Eboo's writing. Our conversation today is about how universities can engage in serious pluralism work, what it means to overcome a framework of diversity that has come to be dominant in many universities, which divides students up between oppressors and the oppressed, and how instead to cultivate the virtues of respecting each other, relating to each other, and cooperating. We also discuss towards the end of a conversation how university leaders should confront the deeply polarized atmosphere on campus and the protest encampments that are now dominating campus life at many institutions around the country. This conversation is part of a broader series about the future of education and how we can overcome its identitarian drift, sponsored by the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Eboo Patel, welcome back to the podcast.
Yascha, thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Eboo, you do a lot of interfaith work and you think very hard about what kind of pluralism we should encourage, how we should encourage people to be in genuine conversation with each other. What has gone wrong in the way that colleges and universities frame those questions and those stakes to their students, the way in which they address their students about the role that identity should play in their lives?
This is a question that is super important, not just about, you know, what's happening in higher education. It's important when it comes to the intellectual and civic life of the nation. It's important when it comes to kind of the instincts of a generation, right? So the way I would describe what's happened in the last 10 years or so, and of course, your book, Yascha, The Identity Trap, is kind of the book on this right now. I'd say what's happened is an interesting critique morphed into a paradigm, which then shifted into a regime, right? So I think anti-racism is an interesting critique. And back in the Obama years, and I'm kind of a big, you know, I talk about myself as kind of operating from the Obama posture on things, right? Optimistic and welcoming and a lot of us and not a lot of them kind of stuff. Back in those days, 2010, 2011, 2012, people in kind of the anti-racism camp would stand up and say, here's what you're not talking about. You're not talking about structural racism. You're not talking about oppressed peoples. You're not talking about oppressors, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's an interesting critique, right? But when it becomes a paradigm, it seeks to explain all of the facts of the world. That's kind of the definition of a paradigm. And now you're in trouble, right? Because there's lots of things that anti-racism doesn't explain. Anti-racism doesn't explain why 57% of the people in higher education are women and only 43% are men. That is not usefully explained by kind of classic left-wing perspectives, patriarchy, structural racism, et cetera, right? It doesn't explain the opioid epidemic in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, rural Ohio, et cetera, So once you kind of lock yourself into an explanatory framework or a paradigm, well, now you're in the situation of kind of twisting the facts of the world to fit your worldview, which, by the way, I think is the cardinal sin of an intellectual. But actually what's happened, it is in some places, it became even worse than a paradigm. It became a regime, right? Which is now all of a sudden it has coercive force and the ability to punish. We are going to require you to write a DEI statement that agrees with our perspective in order for you to be considered as a faculty member at this university. We are going to advertise our bias response team, and we are going to encourage you to report what we think of as bias in order for us to kind of launch an investigation, right? And you get all of these examples of, you know, in our, one of our friends, Yasha, Kwame Anthony Appiah, you know, in a discussion he shared with us that he's reading aloud from a Baldwin text and somebody doesn't like one of the terms that Baldwin uses, one of the great Black writers of the 20th century, and Appiah gets reported to the dean and an investigation ensues, right? That's a regime. Now we're in really dangerous territory. I personally think that oppressed frameworks, while I disagree with them, it's an interesting thing to bring to the table. It's a useful perspective. It should not be a paradigm, and it should absolutely not be a regime. And I think that that's what's happened over the last 10 years. I do want to say that I think, generally speaking, things are getting better. The kind of vice grip of that is loosening. So I see better days ahead for higher education, but for, you know, a certain period of time, it kind of felt like a vice grip.
So there's two ways of interpreting this critique, right? The first is to say that universities shouldn't have a coercive paradigm. They certainly shouldn't have a regime to which all members should intellectually have to pay lip service. It must be possible, particularly in the context of academic research and in the context of speech in the classroom, to have deep disagreements about the kind of topics on which you might have a paradigm. So one critique I'm hearing is we have turned something that was meant to be an intellectual critique that has its advantages but also its drawbacks into something to which people had to pay lip service. For example, when applying for jobs in academia, you have to fill in a DEI statement, and the DEI statement has to have certain kinds of content. Otherwise, it's not going to be given the marks that you need to be considered seriously as a faculty candidate. The other kind of critique is to say, no, look, in some contexts, it's fine for university to have a paradigm. Certainly, it shouldn't be one to which you can't dissent, but when the university is welcoming you to campus, it should express a certain set of values in order to set a culture. And there the critique seems to be more, perhaps this is the wrong paradigm. If you teach 18-year-olds that everything is to be understood in terms of oppressors or the oppressed, then we're going to think that those people who somehow fulfill the criteria of being the oppressed have greater moral standing and greater liberty to do as they wish, and that's going to set up all kinds of negative dynamics on campus. So which critique are you making, or are you making both? Is the problem that something has become a paradigm at all, or is the problem the particular content of the paradigm that was so widely adopted?
It's a great question. I think, Yasha, that it is okay for much of higher education to be, generally speaking, center-left. Notre Dame might choose something different. Wheaton College might choose something different. BYU might choose something different. In other words, there's a certain set of college campuses that say that they have an identity and a heritage and a history, and they're seeking to kind of inculcate an identity, and they are clear about that. I think that that's fine. And I also think it's fine for most higher ed to kind of say we're center left. What do I mean by that, right? We are about intellectual inquiry. We are about civic cooperation. We are about social mobility. But we are open to a variety of ways that these things happen. So we're going to be proactive about helping people who are lower down in the kind of socioeconomic structure get a leg up. And that might include African-American students and Native American students. It might also include rural white students, and it might also include military veterans. But we're going to be proactive about this, right? We are going to encourage questions that other people think are off limits. You know, Kinsey is a great example of this, right? Like, what are the sex lives of Americans? In the middle of the 20th century, that was an off-color question for most people. I'm really glad that Indiana University, of all places, allowed Professor Kinsey to pursue those questions. So intellectual inquiry, civic cooperation, which is to say, we are an institution that brings a wide set of people together, and we encourage them to cooperate. And incidentally, people who are fighting on the other side of the world, Russians and Ukrainians, people of those heritages work together in our laboratories. They study together in our classrooms. They play sports together on our basketball courts and our soccer fields. I think that that's an enormously powerful thing. I associate that with a generally center-left approach. I think that that's fine for much of higher education. And by the way, I welcome kind of questions and critiques of that from center-right approaches, right? Like, I'd be interested in a David French or Father Jenkins from Notre Dame saying, actually, I don't agree with that vision of higher ed. I think those are interesting conversations.
Well, then I'd say that conservatives and people on the center-right can share those same values, right? So they might say that some of what you're saying is somehow overly naive or idealistic or something like that. Or they might say, hang on a second, when you're talking about American institutions being the host for those kinds of exchanges, those are values that we recognize from within our own tradition, and we would sort of dispute that they are somehow exclusively a hallmark of the center-left as opposed to the center-right.
I think that's an excellent point. And in fact, I was at a meeting that was hosted by Elder Clark Gilbert, who is part of the leadership of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He oversees higher education for the church, where he brought together a number of leaders in religious higher education. Father Jenkins from Notre Dame and Shirley Hoekstra of the Council of Christian Colleges and Universities, where they basically said the way that we actually do social mobility is better than the way that most other institutions do it. And they have an argument to make. And this actually gets to the point that I want to make with you, Yasha, is that where I think higher education or any sector goes wrong is when it requires a particular approach. To say we are in favor of social mobility is an ideal that I think it is within the right of higher education to say, this is part of what we do, and we're going to take proactive steps towards that. To say, here is the only way to do it, you have to say every problem can be set at the feet of structural racism or patriarchy, et cetera, and you have to kind of pay lip service to this. That is where I think that we're kind of getting into the territory of dogma. And the fact is, dogma destroys diversity, right? And I find it very interesting that a set of people who say diversity is their highest value are also being extremely dogmatic and saying, but the only way to define positive diversity is our way, and the only way to achieve that end is our way. I think that's a huge problem. Let me give you for me kind of a great example of this, right? So I was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, and I got there through a kind of a distinctive route. I got there through a public institution in the state of Illinois. I got there through the University of Illinois. And most Rhodes Scholars are from, you know, very fancy private institutions, Stanford and Princeton and Harvard and Yale. So I get to Oxford and I'm doing a PhD, and I am not prepared the way that my friends who went to these fancy institutions are. I haven't read the same things that they've read. In fact, I realized that they actually studied with the professors who wrote the books that I read at the University of Illinois. And I said to my PhD advisor, Jeffrey Walford at Oxford, I'm just not as prepared as other people are. And I don't know if I expected him to, like, you know, be more lax in standards because of that. And he looked at me, he's like, well, if you're not as prepared, you work twice as hard. He's basically like, I'm not going to kick you out of the PhD program, but the standards are the standards. And so you're here, time to work twice as hard. So that is one legitimate approach to what it means to achieve the standards, which is don't blame the structure of public institutions in the United States vis-a-vis private institutions. That's a structural explanation. Actually, just work twice as hard, right? And I have to say, I'm enormously grateful for that counsel. And I think that that is a perfectly reasonable way of like achieving the ideal of social mobility. I came in half as prepared. My PhD advisor said, work twice as hard.
So in a speech that you recently held that we're actually about to publish in Persuasion as well, you challenge university leaders to live up to a certain set of tasks that students that embrace the right kind of pluralism should be able to fulfill. What are some of those tasks? What are some of those kinds of challenges? And how well do you think universities are doing at meeting them?
I'm going to answer this first through a story. So there's a famous story about a general or senior member of the armed forces saying, I need somebody for a secret, dangerous mission. I need a West Point football player, right? And the point of the story is that part of what football at West Point, you know, the elite Army Academy does is it prepares you for secret dangerous military missions. And the military actually relies on the football program to teach the skills and the qualities, et cetera, for those missions. Although obviously there's no guns or grenades allowed in the football field, right? So I actually think that this is one way of thinking about higher education, which is it prepares people to be leaders on civic challenges. And so one of the things that I did in this talk was I started with a set of civic challenges we face in the country, principally around civic institutions that are breaking down along the lines of polarization. School boards that are dysfunctional, city councils where they can't pass zoning regulations or approve business licenses because people are at each other's throats over the Middle East war, or a local library in Lake Luzerne, New York, which is now permanently closed because the town had such a heated dispute over drag storytelling hour or something like that, that it just melted down. These are civic institutions that we just expect to work. And I can imagine a situation where the superintendent of a school system or the chair of a library, public library in a small town thinks to herself, you know, we are having such a challenge over polarization that I need a graduate of an excellent diversity program to help us navigate this situation. And I hear that Columbia University or NYU or USC or Stanford has an excellent diversity program. And I'm going to call them and I'm going to say, send us your best graduate. In the same way that a senior military commander might say to West Point, send us your best football player for our secret dangerous mission. And I basically say, I wonder if our universities can say, yes, we are preparing people through our robust diversity work, curricular and co-curricular, to help Lake Luzerne, New York, or Burbank, California, or Teaneck, New Jersey, navigate the polarization and the shutdown it is experiencing over tribalism in its community. And the fact of the matter is, that is not how most diversity programs are put together. But I think that that's how they should be put together. Diversity, I think, is about dealing with the differences you don't like and encouraging cooperation across those disagreements.
So let's get specific here. How are these diversity programs put together, and why do you think that that might make, I take it, some of graduate service programs are sort of participants in that tribal warfare rather than those who can actually facilitate some form of compromise and some form of mutual understanding between the different warring tribes?
I want to say up front here, I think roughly 18 months ago, what I'm about to say was pretty dominant. It was like a vice grip in much of higher ed. I think that this is easing right now. So I want to say, I think things are getting better. And I think that it's because there are a set of really kind of constructed solution-oriented leaders in lots of places, including DEI departments, that are leading things towards the better. But for a period of time, there was no doubt that the dominant diversity paradigm is what I would call demonize, demean, and divide. You demonize some groups of people based literally only on their identity, because they're white, because they're male, because they're straight, because they're whatever. They are only ever bad. Okay. You require other groups of people to demean themselves, to only tell a victim story. I mean, one of the things that I've been saying is, some people want to say right now, tell me all the ways you've been victimized by Islamophobia. And my response is, I want to tell you all the ways that I'm inspired by Islam. It is not Islamophobia that makes me a Muslim. It's Islam that makes me a Muslim. I don't want to tell a victim story. That's demeaning. I want to tell an inspiring story. Identities are principally sources of pride, not statuses of victimization, right? So you demonize some people, you demean other people, and then you divide everybody. And it's a battlefield approach to diversity. That is not a useful way of approaching diversity work. It is an interesting critique. It's not that I want that perspective entirely excluded. I just don't want it to be the paradigm or the default position, right? I think a much better way of approaching diversity work is what we call at Interfaith America, respect, relate, cooperate. You respect people across their differences. You build relationships between diverse communities and you cooperate on concrete projects to serve the common good. And I just don't know any other way to have a diverse democracy. How do you have a diverse democracy unless you can disagree on some fundamental things and work together on other fundamental things? Now, I'm going to say a couple of other things here. So these are clearly major civic challenges in our nation, right? Like imagine signing your kid up for Little League baseball and the person running the league says, hey, who'd you vote for? Because I'm only going to have people on this little league who I agree with politically. Or you call the fire department and you say my house is on fire and they say, what's your address? And oh, by the way, who'd you vote for? You know, when I was in college, I like to say everything is political. But honestly, that's an adolescent view, right? Actually, lots of things are civic. In other words, lots of things are areas in which we broadly agree, like playing Little League and having fire service, and our partisan differences should not exclude people or be the reason we choose some over others, right? Not only, I think, is this an important civic challenge for the nation. You have to have school boards and fire departments and city councils and little leagues that run, that bring together a diversity of people. It is also a hallmark of the American intellectual tradition. For all of our sins and omissions and mistakes as a nation, we are still the first attempt at mass-level diverse democracy. And lots of smart people, from James Madison to Jane Addams to Martin Luther King Jr. to Barack Obama to Yasha Monk, Daniel Allen, Jonathan Haidt, Kwame Anthony Appiah, have addressed themselves to the question, how do people who disagree on all kinds of things not only coexist, but cooperate, right? John and Azu, this is the subject of the book, Confident Pluralism, for example. So there is this great intellectual tradition in American life called pluralism, and it's also a set of skills. And interestingly, over the last 10 years, lots of smart people have written books on what are those skills. So Monica Guzman's book, I Never Thought of It That Way, David Brooks's book, How to Know a Person, you know, Peter Coleman's book. There's lots of books on, well, how do you have a conversation between people from different backgrounds? How do you ask questions in ways that don't provoke arguments and rather invite stories, right? So this kind of combination of things, the civic challenges in the nation, the intellectual tradition that's pluralism, the civic skills that are about cooperation, I think that that's what higher education should be about.
Yeah, it strikes me that the idea that everything is political is what Coleman Hughes would call a deepity, or the other term that is sometimes used for it is a Martin Bailey, which is to say that there is a sense in which that phrase is probably broadly right, which is to say that politics plays a huge role in shaping our lives. The state has now come to have a huge role in society, in economic and other ways. And so therefore, even things that don't seem particularly political are in some ways touched and shaped by politics. And that is the kind of narrow interpretation of that phrase, which is, broadly speaking, one I would agree with. Then there's a much broader incantation or upshot from that phrase that it seems to suggest, which is to say, because everything in some way is touched or shaped by politics, it means that every interaction, every aspect of our life should be open to partisan contestation all of the time. But that is, of course, a much more far-reaching, controversial upshot that some people might agree with, but I, like you, would, for good reason, disagree with. Of course, when it comes to legislation, when it comes to actual political battles, we should in principle be willing to debate every aspect of our social life as shaped by politics. But that means that, you know, you're not going to shake your neighbor's hand because you disagree with them politically. You're not going to come out and address a fire in one of the houses in the neighborhood if the owner of that house has a different political opinion. That is a very, very different kind of sense of politicizing our everyday interactions. And one of the fundamental distinctions between broadly peaceable societies that are affluent and able to cooperate substantively and war-torn societies on the brink of civil war or perhaps in the aftermath of civil war is precisely the ability of well-functioning states to take certain kinds of things out of politics, to not make how the policeman around the corner treats you or how you treat your neighbor dependent on those kind of political questions all of the time.
I think that's a hugely important point. And one of the things I would walk around when I was an undergraduate at the University of Illinois in the mid-1990s, I'd walk around saying all the time, everything is political, everything is political. And of course, part of what I was doing was kind of the equivalent of wearing a Che Guevara shirt. I was like announcing myself as part of a tribe. But frankly, I wish somebody, fellow student or a professor, would have asked me some rigorous questions about that. And this is what I mean about higher education being principally a space of intellectual inquiry. Like, I think you should be asked rigorous questions about that. And it doesn't have to be rude, but hey, is everything really political? Like, would you like the garbage service to only come to people's houses that where the garbage men vote the same? Because there are actually societies like that. And Yasha, it's interesting, like when I kind of had to confront this head on was when I was reading a New York Times story 5 or 7 years ago that opened with the line, it was a story about Mostar and Bosnia-Herzegovina. And Mostar is not a city in hot conflict, right? And yet it's a city in this kind of cold civic peace, I think you might call it, but it's far from ideal. The story begins with the line, when there is a fire on the Catholic side of the city of Mostar, the Muslim fire department does not respond. And when there's a fire on the Muslim side, the Catholic fire department does not respond. And it just so happened that I'm reading this story when I'm in Bend, Oregon on a family vacation with my family. And there's like literally fires on three sides of us, you know, wildfires. And I have this realization, oh my gosh, there's all of these people fighting these fires and keeping my family safe. And I don't know how they voted. I don't know how they pray. Right. And they probably disagree with me on lots and lots of things. Right. I'm like, in some ways, a quintessential urban, highly educated progressive. I live in Whole Foods America. And yet we have a nation because we fight fires for everybody. We pick up garbage for everybody. Right. And to not pay attention to what John Courtney Murray would call the underlying community that holds our diverse identities and divergent ideologies together, to not pay attention to the strength of that, to not contribute to that, is kind of a, you know, it is an adolescent perspective that displays how much we take for granted in the United States of America, the 21st century.
To me, when I'm in the classroom, the point is to ask rigorous questions of any set of views, including the ones that I disagree with and the ones that I do agree with. And I find it hard sometimes to establish the confidence in the students at the beginning of term that they don't need to just echo my political views. And that is because while many professors do the same as I do, there are some who don't. There are some who make it very clear to students that it's going to be much easier to get a good grade if you just echo back to the professor what they believe. As long as you engage in the right verbal incantations, you're going to have a much easier way to pass the class. And one of the ways that I can build that trust in the first sessions is to make it very clear that I expose any set of views to the same rigorous questions, that no set of views is sacrosanct, or views are going to be interrogated in this kind of way, which is thorough but respectful. I was really intrigued earlier by the three terms you used in describing the work you do in your interfaith work: respect, relate, cooperate. And of course, I can see immediately the resistance by some of the people who would claim that everything's political to say, well, how can you respect somebody who has voted for Donald Trump? How can you relate to somebody who is, quote unquote, white supremacist and so on and so forth? But I think that those values clearly are important. What does that mean? How do you respect somebody in a religious context when you might have very fundamental theological differences with them? How should you respect somebody in a political context who you think might be voting for a political candidate who you consider dangerous to the survival of your political system?
In answering this question, let me begin by saying, I think one of the reasons that religious diversity is an excellent kind of entree point into broader pluralism work is precisely because interfaith work that specifically involves people from different religious communities you have to recognize that people have fundamental differences in doctrine, fundamental differences and disagreements on what Paul Tillich would call ultimate concerns, right? How do people come into this world and why, right? In a cosmic way, where do people go after they die? Who gets saved? For, you know, what makes a good person, et cetera, right? Like, you just have to recognize there are deep and fundamental disagreements, and you have to figure out ways to work together anyway, right? And so what's interesting is, you don't begin principally with the question of power, who is powerful and who's not powerful. You begin principally with the issue of fundamental disagreements and the need to cooperate anyway. And of course, this is one of the things that the European founders of the 1776 generation, they come closest to getting right. It's interesting. We spent all of this time talking about their sins and omissions and mistakes, principally around race, also about gender and sexuality and class. We spend very little time recognizing they got something pretty close to right, which is around religious diversity.
Let me dig into this for a second. Why is it that there is this fundamental difference in how we approach interfaith work and speaking with fellow citizens who have different political views? Which is to say that when you approach interfaith work, I think it's intuitive to most people that the point is not to convert others, right? If you're saying, oh, I'm doing interfaith work as a Christian, and I'm going to meet with Jews and Muslims, but really my purpose for the meeting is to make sure that they get saved and that they come to agree with my theological views. Say, well, hang on a second, that you're really approaching that in the wrong way. And I think most of us would find that to be intuitive. In a political context, it feels much less surprising, much less counterintuitive to say, well, you know, if I'm going over to speak with my neighbor who votes for the other political party, really what I'm trying to do is to make sure that eventually they vote for the same political party as I do. It's not obvious to me why that's something we find intuitive, because after all, the stakes in religion are as high as they are in politics. If you believe that being safe and going to heaven depends on having the right theological view, you know, it's no easier to say, I'll leave that at the door and my purpose in this meeting is not to convert you, than it is in politics, where the stakes are surely also high, but not obviously higher than going to heaven or hell.
So our approach in this is actually quite the same. And I think one of the reasons interfaith work leads into the very important pluralism work of today, which is around political differences, is precisely because our approach to this is largely the same, which is, hey, listen, members of the Catholic faith and members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they have very different views on, for example, what the proper ecclesiology is, right? But they also both have large social service networks and disaster relief organizations. And therefore, in some instances around disaster relief, right, around refugee resettlement, they put their doctrinal differences aside and they work together on what I would call civic causes. I think it's the exact same approach when it comes to politics. People who vote for Donald Trump and Joe Biden clearly have hugely important differences and disagreements. I am not neutral on those, right? Like I said, I'm a center-left person. I operate from what I call the Obama position. And yet, I do not want basketball leagues to split up. I don't want YMCAs to split up. I don't want fire departments to split up because of who people voted for. So again, our big thing is, in order to have a diverse democracy, you have to be able to disagree on some fundamental things and work together on other fundamental things. Those things that we work together on are civic things that are in a different place in American life than our disagreements, whether they are religious or they are political in nature. And look, I have limits. You know, I like to say I'm not buying a brownie from the Nazi bake sale, but otherwise, I am learning how to cooperate with people. And in the right time, I might raise a conversation about those political differences. I might raise a conversation even about religious differences. I'm a Muslim. I believe in Islamic doctrine. The Prophet Muhammad is the final prophet, et cetera, right? I'm happy to have that conversation, but I'm not going to threaten a civic relationship in order to have that conversation.
What does it mean to respect in the political context in that way? Presumably in a religious context, it means something like, look, we have fundamental differences about what God we believe in, whether we believe in God, what kind of ritual we think we should engage in. But, you know, I recognize that you come from a meaningful theological tradition and that you're somebody informed by faith, and that gives me a certain kind of respect for you, even if we disagree very strongly about the important particulars. What is the political equivalent of that? Sort of how much relating to somebody who votes for Donald Trump do I need to do? In what sense do I have to respect them? And in what sense can I say, hey, I think you're deeply wrong, or the candidate you support is a dangerous man?
I mean, I think that the first important thing here is curiosity and a recognition that each of us has a limited life experience. And in the United States, those life experiences are increasingly distinct from each other, right? So let me tell you a story where voting for Trump, I was like, oh, I see it now. Whereas before, I couldn't even imagine it, which, by the way, is my fault. Like, it is the challenge of democratic citizenship to be able to imagine why other people might act the way that they do, again, within certain reasonable limits. Like, I don't want to have a sympathetic understanding of Nazis, but most people, I want to have an understanding. Why do you act that way? So let me tell you the story. So I, again, highly educated, PhD from Oxford. I live in a world of people, lots of graduate degrees and, you know, a comfortable neighborhood in Chicago, Whole Foods, America. In fact, Yasha, you've been over to my house, right? We passed the Whole Foods on the way, I think. So I'm at a party, you know, a dinner party with lots of folks like me. And one of the people I meet is a consultant, and we're in this casual conversation. And he's like, yeah, I work for a firm that basically unwinds factories. Once the decision has been made to close a factory, I'm the person that they send to kind of close it down and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm like, oh, that's interesting. You know, what's that like? Da, da, da. And he's going through the different places he's been. And of course, he lives in Chicago, and he's making all these disparaging comments about Decatur, Illinois, and Youngstown, Ohio, and all these places he's going to close down factories. And I say to him at one point, I'm like, how do the people who work at those factories feel about you showing up and basically shutting it down? And he, like, you know, takes another sip of wine and puts, you know, a cracker with, you know, whatever, like fig jam and Gouda in his mouth. And he says, yeah, you know, by the time I show up, they already know what the deal is. They've already gotten their pink slip. The writing is on the wall. So, you know, they kind of accept it. Then he pauses and he's like, you know what? The truth is, I never asked them how they feel. And I'm like, oh. And I'm thinking to myself, this is just my world. My world is a set of people who close down other people's factories. And I just think that that's natural, right? It's just natural, right? It's creative destruction. Oh, but my friends get to be the creative ones. Other people are the destroyed ones. And I was like 40 years old when I had this conversation and this realization, like, oh my gosh, I live in a world of people who don't even think twice or ask the question, how does it feel to have your factory shut down? And all of a sudden, I'm like, huh, I wonder what it would like to be on the other side of that. I wonder what messages might appeal to me. I wonder what figures I might find compelling.
Yeah, and one of the sort of strange things about the dominant paradigm, which has taken over in many institutions and more broadly in the tone of a lot of public debate, is a pride in not being interested in the other side. I mean, one way of telling the story is that when the New York Times and other mainstream news outlets had missed the boat on Trump in 2015, 2016, had thought that it was impossible that he might win, impossible that he would win the nomination, impossible that he would be competitive in the general election, there was a brief moment when they did this sort of diner journalism, where they would go around to diners in the middle of a country and speak to people about how they felt. And there was something slightly ridiculous about some of those pieces. They were trying to overcompensate for a much deeper lack of curiosity that was much longer in standing in a way that felt performative. And I didn't like all of the pieces that came out of that. But at least it was, in fact, trying to understand half of the country. And then there was a huge counter-reaction against that. On Twitter, as it was considered at the time, anything that could be portrayed as a form of this kind of diner journalism was just ruthlessly marked as a form of normalizing fascism, basically. And I think it created, at least for a while, a new set of norms where trying to understand the life stories and the motivations of people with very different political views came to be seen as in itself a political flaw, a political failing. And I think that we still retain that aggressive lack of curiosity as a hallmark of a kind of social circle in which you and I move. And one of the ways I always think about this is that many of my friends and colleagues have more curiosity for the beliefs of any traditional community anywhere in the world no matter how morally worrying we might think some of the customs may be, than they do for people within their own country who stand on the other side of a political spectrum, right? You can understand the customs of various tribes that are extremely patriarchal, that engage in serious forms of violence, because that is sort of anthropologically interesting and you try to have respect for people with different styles of life. But when it comes to, you know, a voter in rural Mississippi, you just assume there must be a bad person.
Yeah, I think this is bad. So I spent a lot of time on college campuses. My organization, Interfaith America, does a lot of work in higher education. We work currently with a network of 600 campuses. And as you can imagine, our phone has been ringing off the hook in recent months, right? I distinctly remember this story that not long after the election of Donald Trump, I'm at some elite college in Ohio. I don't remember if it was Oberlin or Kenyon. And I'm meeting with the students of color group. And, you know, there's just an awful lot of very overwrought self-righteous talk about being oppressed and the institution not understanding their experiences. And it's self-righteous in nature, right? Like it's not like I'm sad. It's like I'm self-righteous. And I'm listening to it. By the way, I was this 19-year-old. I'm not being judgmental or trying to not be judgmental. I'm trying to understand, you know, this position. And, you know, I felt very out of place when I was a state university educated student at Oxford. I'm sure I said these kinds of things. Anyway, I'm listening to all of this. And at some point, I noticed the woman putting out the coffee and tea and cookies for our students, right? And a student says something especially self-righteous and kind of especially revolutionary. And this woman like turns around and just gives me this look. And she's this woman who looks like she's 55. She's kind of this small white woman. And she opens her mouth and she's missing half her teeth. And I just have this thought, like, would you rather be a 19-year-old South Asian American student at Kenyon, or would you rather be this 55-year-old white woman putting out the tea and cookies for the students at Kenyon, missing half of her teeth? And this is like at the height of the opioid epidemic, right, in this part of the state. And I kind of wanted to say to these students, like, do you notice her? Who would you rather be? And interestingly enough, why in our conversations about oppressor and oppressed, again, a framework I dislike, right? But let's bring the perspective to the table. Why do we never count elite education as, frankly, the single most important identity that puts you at the top of the hierarchy? I mean, if you think about elite education and what the identity means, like basically, you are seeking to be part of an institution that by definition rejects the vast majority of the people who want to be a part of it. The school where I got my PhD, the school where you teach, its place in the world is based on rejecting other people. So, you know, as John Haidt writes in The Righteous Mind, or maybe it was The Coddling of the American Mind, why are you mad at the Catholic Church for rejecting women as priests, which, you know, not crazy about, but they have a right to their identity, if you're not mad at your own institution for rejecting 95% of its applicants, and you recognize that that is a part of why you wanted to go there?
I sometimes tell my students that they're all part of the elite. Now, for many students, that's doubly true. Many students come from households that are in the top 1% of income, you know, have grown up in the big metropolitan centers of a country of tremendous opportunity. Some students come from generally disadvantaged backgrounds and have overcome impressively great hurdles to be admitted to an elite institution like that. But everybody who's in the room at a place like Johns Hopkins is at least a budding member of a future elite, is likely to join the most influential group of American society by virtue of the place that they are graduating from. And in a way that I understand, that I would have felt when I was 19 or 20, they bristle at that. But I hope that it helps them understand the kind of way in which, for all of the differences between them, for all the ways in which some of them had a much easier start in life than others, they are joining a social elite and should be aware of that. And one of the strange consequences of the oppressor-oppressed framework is, of course, to hide that, is to make you feel like if you are non-white in any kind of way, or you have any kind of sexual orientation that can be counted as not being a cis, white, male, heterosexual, and so on, then you're on the part of the oppressed. And that, of course, undermines what has traditionally been the one saving grace of social elites that have always been rather self-serving, and I think there's no reason to have nostalgia for elites of past years, but at least many of them knew they were elites, and that came with some kind of sense in the best circumstances of noblesse oblige. What may be new about today's social elite is that so many members of it have a self-conception of not being a member of the elite at all. And that does seem to flow in part from this normative framework and to be something rather new. I think it's hard to think of historical examples where the elite didn't admit to itself of being the elite.
Look, I think this is a big problem. And I think it's a big problem for a number of reasons. One is, for most people in most households, identities are presented as sources of pride. Okay, so in my house, we talk to our kids all the time about how privileged they are. And we literally use that word to be of Indian heritage and of Muslim faith. You are privileged. And then, you know, because I'm a geek, I will quote T.S. Eliot, right? You do not inherit traditions. You work to make yourself worthy of them. You don't inherit this wonderful thing called Islam or Indian heritage, right? Like there are things that you have to work towards that allow you to be in this circle, right? So in Islam, there's a term called ihsan, which is excellence, which is what we should all strive for. So number one, thinking of yourself as oppressed, it doesn't allow you then to see your identity as something to work up to have a responsibility. Second thing is, the American university is amongst the greatest social mobility institutions built in human history. And to not understand it as such, to not like embrace and be appreciative of that opportunity that it's affording people, I think is a real problem, right? Bryan Stevenson, who I think is the greatest social justice figure in America right now, he talks about being at Eastern University when he was a student and walking around and being like, I'm a college student. How amazing is this? And I think that that's kind of the right attitude, frankly, to much of life, to be like, how amazing is it that I am in this place and that I can take advantage of these opportunities? And so I think anything that kind of dulls that appreciation or sense of gratitude is a bad thing. I think a third thing is, if you think of yourself as lucky or blessed or privileged, then I think a sense of having a responsibility is a natural outgrowth of that. And then you look at your education as a way of learning knowledge and skills and qualities that help you serve others, right? And I think that that's the right way to approach an education is, I am lucky to be here. I am proud of my identities. And it is my responsibility to cultivate myself such that I am, you know, in Islamic language, Ramatul Alameen, a special mercy upon all the worlds, as opposed to, I'm going to proactively look for all the ways that I have been wronged and harmed. And then I'm going to shake my fist at the world, right? Actually, the world is counting on you to improve it. The world is counting on you.
So how do we do better, Ibu? If a lot of the problem is that the wrong kind of mental framework has become part of a governing regime of universities, if it feels like to some extent there's started to be a little bit of pushback against this in the last months, at least there now seems to be a genuine opening for university leaders to rethink the way in which they do pluralism work or diversity work on their campus. What is, in the first instance, the content we should put in the place of the old framework? And then perhaps as a follow-up question later, I'll ask you, how do we go about actually making those changes?
So one interesting thing we haven't talked about thus far is DEI, right? It's funny, like I almost never use the word DEI anymore because it just polarizes, right? But I have a metaphor that I think might be useful, which is, I think of DEI as the equivalent of an athletic department at a university. So I think of it structurally. And again, I spend a lot of time at universities, and so I'm kind of involved in these structures quite intimately. And an athletic department is meant to have many sports. And I think it is okay. In fact, you know, one of my favorite sports is football. It's a confrontational sport, right? And I think for the past several years, DEI departments have been dominated by football. It's been dominated by confrontation. And I think it's time for baseball season. It's time for cooperation. Now, because I operate from the center left, I think that cooperation should be towards kind of generally center left goals, like social mobility, right? like intellectual inquiry, like civic cooperation. Incidentally, I'm very happy for my friends on the center right, you know, David French and Elder Clark Gilbert and Father Jenkins at Notre Dame and Phil Reichen at Wheaton College and Shirley Hoekstra. I'm very happy for them to say, these are also center right goals. Great. Then we share them, right? But basically, I think it's time for us to shift the approach from confrontation to cooperation, from the raised fist to the extended hand, right? And actually, interestingly enough, if somebody told me recently that the original symbol for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, when it was founded in the early 1960s, was two hands, I think a black hand and a white hand, clasped together. Somebody will have to check my facts on that. I just heard that from somebody, but I find that really, really inspiring. So let me just say, and this is going to be counterintuitive, I think, to your audience, Yasha. I actually think most people numerically in diversity work are instinctively cooperation people. I just think that the loudest voices and in effect, suffocatingly loud voices have been the confrontation people over the past few years. And it's the equivalent of every season being football season, every stadium being a football stadium. And when it's finally time for baseball season, actually the football players show up in full gear and they're tackling the baseball players, right? So I actually think there's lots of good people on campuses who want to do cooperation work and increasingly are like tired of being tackled by the football players, right? By the way, let me say again, I like football. I think confrontation is okay at some points, but it cannot be the only way we do things all the time, and it cannot be the default mode. So I would just say, I think college campuses should do a little bit of what I talked about earlier, should ask themselves the question, what are the civic challenges in our nation when it comes to diversity issues? And one of the clear ones is civic institutions melting down because of polarization and tribalism. Right? You cannot have school boards, city councils, fire departments, libraries that are unable to operate because people have different political perspectives, right? In response to this, a university should say, our diversity program prepares people to help folks in those institutions and in those communities respect their fundamental differences and cooperate on other things, right? And we do that by presenting those issues as case studies. We literally take them straight off the front page of the New York Times here at Interfaith America. We teach the intellectual tradition of pluralism, right? Again, it is much political philosophy in America is about how do people from different identities work together, right? And we teach the civic skills of cooperation. I think that this actually makes for a great major at a university or a minor, right? There are certainly enough books and there are certainly enough cases that would make up substantive material for this.
So in concrete terms, let's say that you are the president of a university or you're the dean of students at a university and you take an audit, formal or informal, of how your institution is doing and you recognize that this currently isn't the case, that when students arrive, the relevant administrators train them in a oppressor-oppressed set of binaries, that there isn't really much emphasis on civic cooperation and the ability to work together. And you also realize that any change you are trying to make in this is likely to be decried by perhaps a small number of the members of the institution, perhaps people who actually do not represent the genuine voice of a majority of students or faculty members, but who have a loud microphone and who are willing to hurl terrible insults at you to justify why you must not be allowed to succeed. What is your first step? And what is your fifth and tenth step? How do you actually transform the kind of atmosphere that your university is creating for the incoming students as well as the other members of the community?
So I want to make a quick comment, Yasha, about the last part of your question and then answer concretely the first part, which is what should a university do? So I have been in more than one chancellor's office, right, with a director of DEI, and we are talking about how to implement a broad curricular or co-curricular program, principally co-curricular because you know the co-curricular staff at a university reports up to the president, the faculty does not. So how do you implement broad-based programs, workshops, trainings, public lecture series, et cetera, that would encourage pluralism or civic cooperation? And literally the the chancellor of the university will look at the DEI director and say, well, you know, these two faculty members or staff members are going to raise a stink about this. How do we deal with that? And for the next 30 minutes, we are talking about how to deal with two people who might, you know, raise a stink. And I'm like, this is a problem. It is clear to me that a majority of people want to focus on cooperation across difference to lift everybody up. And there's a handful of folks who think they can destroy it all. That is a reality at many places, and it's a problem. As far as actually implementing this kind of work, so, you know, I co-wrote an article with my colleague, Rebecca Russo, here at Interfaith America. She's the vice president of our higher education practice, called The Pluralism Practices for Higher Education. We'll maybe link to it in the podcast. And it's seven practices that college campuses can implement that will help a campus be what we call an exemplar of pluralism. So one is the president makes public statements and speeches about the importance of pluralism. You go to the local chamber of commerce and you say, hire our students because they can help your company, your school system, your hospital system, the people in those institutions cooperate across their differences. You have a crisis management plan, right? So if a crisis hits, and crises are going to hit, whether it's pro-life issues and pro-life, pro-choice issues or violence in the Middle East, how do you handle a crisis that naturally polarizes when it hits? Every first-year student should be trained in the skills of cooperation across difference. That should be standard training. Certainly every student leader on campus, if you're a resident advisor, if you're the president of a club, you should be trained in the kind of things that David Brooks and Monica Guzman and Arthur Brooks and Peter Coleman talk about in their books. You should have a curriculum. You should have a some kind of certificate or degree program in pluralism that teaches both the intellectual tradition. Again, you know, Daniel Allen and Kwame Anthony Appiah and John Anazu all the way back to James Madison, you know, like this great American intellectual tradition of how do people from different identities cooperate across their differences. So it's these pluralism practices that we think campuses can gives them a roadmap to how to become what we call an exemplar of pluralism. I think the place to start is first-year orientation, right? Like, I think that if a college president sat through the full 3 days of freshman orientation at their university, they might be surprised by how identity issues are presented. It might not be, you know, diversity as a potluck, which is our preferred metaphor, right? A potluck is a common space where people bring distinctive dishes and you're looking for creative combinations and enriching conversations, right? That is our preferred metaphor for how diversity in America or on a college campus should work. Very often, diversity is presented as a battlefield, right? Identity is viewed as either a source of shame, oh, I'm sorry, I'm too privileged, or as a source of victimization. You know, I'm oppressed and I feel self-righteous about it. Neither of those ways of thinking of identity, either shame or victimization, lends itself to let us live in positive, mutually enriching loyalty to one another in this enterprise and experiment we call America, which is, I think, what we all have to dedicate ourselves to now and for a long time into the future.
Yeah, that seems exactly right to me. I deliberately didn't start this conversation talking about the headlines, but obviously there is a huge protest movement going on at American universities at the moment. There's very, very, very deep division on campuses between different groups. We have seen both the occupation of many common spaces and violation of university rules, and then the decision by a good number of university presidents at this point to call in the police. To what extent do you think that good pluralism work could have prevented the escalation of these situations? And what would you say to university presidents who are now faced with difficult decisions about how to respond?
It's hard to tell if these things could have been prevented, right? Arguing a counterfactual is impossible to do. But I will say, if the default mode on campuses were set to civic cooperation, if, you know, campuses years ago were implementing these pluralism practices, if first-year orientation presented identity and diversity issues as a potluck and not as a battlefield, I think there is a a greater chance that people would have said, I'm going to lean in and learn how to understand people with whom I might not understand and look to cooperate with them. By the way, I want to say that is happening in lots of places, right? It's not the headlines, right? The media covers planes that crash, not planes that land. We all know that. It is also the case that the default mode on many campuses has been set to confrontation. Right. And there's no doubt in my mind that that has created the conditions for some of what we're seeing right now. Let me just say, like, I come out of pacifism. I come out of the thinking of King and Gandhi and Jeanette Rankin and Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama. So I have a lot of sympathy for people who are like, stop wars. Stop wars. And I think that all sides should be asked to stop, incidentally. But I have a lot of sympathy for that. I also think there's so many people, including me, who just feel helpless in this moment, like who watch the violence in the Middle East and just feel totally helpless. And I think part of what 18 and 19-year-olds do is say, I'm going to do something. And I appreciate that. And at the same time, I think it is absolutely egregious that a student says, I'm going to kill Zionists in January, and that person is still a student on a campus. And one has to ask oneself, is there a permission structure that has been built for demeaning, ugly, violent, anti-Semitic things to be said to some people? And I think the answer to that has to be yes, right? And so what is that structure? You know, and I think some of it is oppressed-oppressor frameworks. The oppressed can never do anything wrong in this framework. The oppressor can never do anything right. You know, I also want to say, that is very salient right now as we talk. I do not think it is the dominant experience on college campuses. There's 2,600 campuses in America. The New York Times pays attention to 50, okay, right? They pay attention to, you know, whatever the percentage is, a very small percentage. Most days on most college campuses are good days. But I think this notion that you come to a college campus, you find people who you don't understand and don't agree with, and then you scream at them. I just don't think that that's like where the default mode should be set on any campus. And I think that it's an important thing for campuses to employ professionals who specialize in cooperation across disagreement. That is what they're good at. That is what they're good at. And I have no doubt that there have been some chancellors who, you know, look down from their seventh floor office and see students screaming at each other in the quads. And they're like, boy, there's a fire out there. I'm sure I have a fire department on this campus. Don't I have a diversity set of diversity professionals who can help these students learn from one another and talk, or at least de-escalate? And then somebody whispers in your ear, actually, you know, some of our people have been the fire starters. I want to be clear. I don't think this is all people. It's certainly not all campuses, right? But there are some loud voices whose principal approach to things is confrontation. And I think we are at a danger point in confrontation in American life. And it's time for a different season. It's time for cooperation across differences to lift everybody up.
I agree with you on all of that. I still wonder what university presence should do at this point. And obviously that's going to depend on the particular circumstances and particular campuses, right? It depends on the extent to which classes are disrupted, towards the usual normal functioning of the university is disrupted. It depends on the ability to negotiate with the leaders of these protests in good faith, or the extent to which they're refusing any kind of good faith negotiation. But what kind of principles do you think university leaders should apply to how to respond to these protests?
So I'm going to take a professorial approach to this, Yasha. One is, this is actually how I think about things. And the other is we're in the middle of a controversy right now. And I think one of the things that thinkers should do is try to remove themselves just a little bit, right, sometimes. And so I want to encourage two exercises, right? One is the Harvard Business School exercise, which is, imagine you're in charge. And it's the case study approach, right? So imagine you are President Shafeek at Columbia University, and these are the reports you're getting, and these are the rules, and this is the pressure you're getting. What would you do? And I always think that's a much more challenging position to be in. Imagine you're in charge, and what's the decision you would make, as opposed to what is your critique of the decision that somebody else made,
I think that's absolutely right. And I know Minoush Shafiq a little bit. I think she's a very decent and principled person, and she's in a terrible position right now, as are many university leaders. But the thing that always annoys me about a lot of punditry is that when you're a policymaker, let's take it out of the current context of campus, right? You have course of action A available to you. And that is going to have good effects K and bad effects L and M. Or you have option B in front of you, and that has good effects A, X, and bad effects Y and Z. And let's say that you choose A, because on the whole, you think that it's a close run, but that's mildly preferable, right? And then there's people pointing out saying, you damn idiot, don't you see that you've caused L and M? How can you be such a terrible person? And it's just, unless you've actually engaged seriously with the different trade-offs, that is a very, very simplistic thing to do. Because you might well, the leader may well have been aware of those bad consequences. They may have rued those consequences. They may have sleepless night about those consequences. But perhaps Y and Z are even worse. So it's for you to take that choice seriously and to balance those different things, not just to be the kibitzer in chess language, a person looking on saying, haha, you idiot, haven't you realized that the decision you took had that kind of drawback?
I think that's exactly right. And not to mention, these are unpredictable situations. You get several hundred people together. And so right now it's a demonstration. And who knows when it's going to become a mob? And who knows when it's going to become a riot? Now, I am not saying that that is the case, right? But what's interesting, you know, living here in Chicago, there is all kinds of legitimate criticism about how is it that you call out a police response in such an aggressive way on Laquan McDonald, who was shot several times by Jason Van Dyke in a egregious situation. And then similarly, there's how did you not call the police on this fight outside of Fenger High School in which a kid got murdered? And these are unpredictable. So the point is that it is one kind of situation at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, another kind of situation at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And that is an enormously challenging place to be. But one of the things our institutions of higher education should do is not simply produce critics, but produce leaders, right? What does it look like to be in charge? And so I think that that is an exercise that people should go through. What does this look like? And what decision would you make? And at what point would you make it? And not just, you know, if you make it at 1 o'clock, this might happen, but what might happen at 3 o'clock if you make a different decision, right? So that's one thing. Here's a second kind of standard intellectual approach to this. And by the way, I think rigorous thinking is really important. And so I think the classroom going through these exercises is a very important moment, even in the heat of the moment. It's a very important thing to do, even in the heat of the moment, which is, let's find an interesting analogy. And when it comes to protests around a divisive issue on a campus near commencement, there's actually a very close analogy from not that long ago. And those were the protests against President Barack Obama's commencement address at the University of Notre Dame. I think it was either 2009 or 2010. And it actually has a lot of similar elements to it. So number one, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who come from off campus to participate in these protests. Number two, there's an overnight element, right? At Notre Dame, they call them prayer sessions, but, you know, I imagine there were tents up, right? So you have an overnight encampment of people who are breaking campus rules to engage in their protests. Number three, there is some aggressive language being used, right? A baby killer is said a lot. Number four, there are dozens of arrests. Number five, there is actual disruption of the commencement proceedings. And so people stand up during President Obama's commencement address and they start to scream things, right? So it's a really interesting analogy, right? And of course, this is part of how intellectuals work. You like find an analogy and you work through it and you think to yourself, okay, if you believe your cause allows you to create protest, civil disobedience, disruption in this kind of a way. And let's be clear about what's happening at a place like Columbia or NYU right now, which is cancer researchers cannot get to their laboratories. You are causing a disruption in the everyday life of a university, and that everyday life is actually really important. People do very important things at universities. So if you judge your cause important enough to cause that disruption, and incidentally, note, I am not betraying my own view on that. Can somebody else judge their cause important enough to cause that disruption? Is every cause on the planet important enough to be able to shut down a college? Or, you know, in my case, I I had a very important event that I was speaking at a couple of Mondays ago in DC, and I could not get to O'Hare because protesters had shut down O'Hare Airport, right? So if your cause is important enough to shut down an airport, and maybe it is somebody else's cause that important? What can somebody else shut down your life over? And I think that these two questions, what does it mean to be in charge? How would you go through the, how would you make those decisions? And can we reason by analogy and come to some general principles by analogy? I would say the default position should be set to, in most situations, we cooperate. In most situations, the norms of American life are that we recognize we will disagree on some fundamental things and agree on other fundamental things. And that is how you have little leagues and hospitals and fire departments and city councils. And it is actually a miracle to have a nation where people of diverse identities and divergent ideologies are most of the time cooperating in those civic institutions. I think it is a treasure that we should cherish.
Ibu Patel, thank you so much for your optimism, for your spirit of cooperation, for your insights, and for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Yasha.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good Fight. Lots of listeners have been spreading the word about this show. If you too have been enjoying the podcast, please be like them. Rate the show on iTunes, tell your friends all about it, share it on Facebook or Twitter. And finally, please mail suggestions for great guests or comments about the show to goodfightpod@gmail.com. That's goodfightpod@gmail.com.
This recording carries a Creative Commons 4.0 international license, thanks to Silent Partner for their song, Chess Pieces.